The title of this session is Effective Handoffs of Care in the Perioperative Period. My name is Juan Sanchez from Baltimore. My co-moderator is Ashley Burgess from Winnipeg. And our first speaker is Dr. Kevin Lobdell from Charlotte, North Carolina. The title of his talk is Handoffs in High Performance and High Reliability Organizations, Application of Technology and the Internet of Things.
Thanks, Juan. Thanks, audience. Honored to be here. I'll take you on a little bit of a personal journey, and we'll do this in somewhat informal way and hopefully stimulate some thoughts and some good discussion. So topics that we'll sort of cover today, I'll tell you in advance, we'll summarize it at the end so you can think about it a little bit, but everything from institutional learning to high performance, high reliability, and quality improvement to the communication, standard operating procedures, so habits or routines, strategies, and then as we allude to in the title of the talk, a little bit of the digital health, Internet of Things that are relevant in today's world. Just to give you a little background, my background's in cardiac surgery. That's probably somewhere in the early 90s in New Haven, Connecticut, where Juan and I were cardiac surgery residents together. We haven't changed at all. That said, I learned some lessons along the way, very personally, in the importance of high performance, high reliability. That's me, 2002, after a car accident, where my hand was basically separated from my forearm and my career changed. I ended up going back and doing a critical care fellowship, business school, and doing clinical work, but also leading a team, you know, in the unit and working on performance reliability for cardiovascular services. I don't know if they're truly conflicts, but things that are worth talking about, relevant. I have a grant from the Duke Endowment and do independent quality consulting for Medtronic. So, as I mentioned, we'll talk a little bit about institutional learning, continuous improvement, high performance, high reliability today, and the importance of learning faster than others, which may be the only durable competitive advantage. At the center of all this, and you'll hear a lot about it, it's really value in being proportional to quality and inversely proportional to the resources we put into it. So if you just looked at all of what we're doing as a system, you want something that is high quality, safe, patient-centered, that sort of thing, judicious use of resources, and that's how we derive value. And again, as I alluded to earlier, this is in a network decentralized world. No longer do we think just in terms of showing up for a shift, necessarily delivering care to one particular group of people, but it's far more networked than that. An example of that is here as we're working in our cardiac ICU, and probably many of you using EICU technology. So early on, we realized, as more was expected of us, we were going to have to be creative. So you see there on the top a point of care database. What we did was create unique patient identifier, and every time somebody told us we needed to do something new, like control their glucose or extubate early, we just added that to what we considered our standard operating procedure, and we had the charge nurse in the unit track those things. And so not only did we have real-time tracking of that, but real-time management of those goals. And then ultimately the next diagram that you see down was something that we used on a monthly basis when we'd get the whole team together, and we'd have an individual and we'd have some particular process that they owned, and then talk about where we were with respect to the goal and the direction we were going, that sort of thing. And then the bottom is cumulative sum chart, so we would, on a monthly basis, share this with the entire team, but on a weekly basis, we would know where we stood with respect to risk-adjusted outcomes. And so in essence, what you have there is the actions that we take linking to leading key performance indicators and then ultimately outcomes, whereby we would all have ideas, insight, we would learn, and we would improve together. So if you think about that, say, in the realm of cardiac surgery or a cardiac surgery ICU, let's think, for instance, early extubation. That would be something that we'd be asking the team to focus on their actions, and that would ultimately be the leading key performance indicator linked to what we thought were better outcomes, less mortality, less major morbidity. So with that in mind, high-performance organization, in my mind, they're marked importantly by three things: common aspirational goals, alignment, and accountability. I mentioned adaptability, but most specifically, again, common aspirational goals, alignment, accountability. It has an action bias and a strong focus on what it wants to achieve. I think of this like quality, what you want to happen. High reliability organizations, I think in terms of safety, and there's this real focus on failure, what you don't want to happen, and it requires leadership commitment, the culture of safety, and effective utilization of performance improvement tools. So again, it'll overlap with quality, but make no mistake that the mindset and some of the tools are a little different when we speak of reliability versus performance. If you thought about a race car, for example, the performance part is you want it to go fast. The reliability part is you don't want it to break down. This car could go really fast, but doesn't make it to the end of the race. It's not much good. So again, a little bit of context. 2010, I started thinking about literally perfect care. It scared a lot of people in the organization. Like, well, if we talk about that and we don't live up to it, what does it mean? And my thoughts continue to evolve. And ultimately, it led to the grant that I mentioned from the Duke Endowment, and we've begun to announce this novel cardiac care initiative across six hospitals in the Carolinas. The Duke Endowment is focused particularly on the Carolinas, meaning North and South Carolina, and I'll share with you a little bit about what we're thinking about here. So with perfect care, active monitoring through all phases, you've all thought about or participated in the EICU, but we think we can use that same technology, everything from pre-op and or prehabilitation in the periprocedural home to the, say, post-acute care phases as well. Not only that, even on the floor. Passive monitoring in this periprocedural home, you probably all read about some of these things, you may even use them like Fitbit. But there's no reason that we shouldn't be using these novel biosensors to collect information and support the decision making that we have. And the way I thought about this was it's novel data, it's additional data, and it can certainly augment the existing risk model. So it provides that opportunity for us to learn in today's world in real time and adjust our actions. We've also talked about having a collaborative, so again, aggregating the data, not from just one facility, but from multiple facilities within the region, much like John's group in cardiac surgery does in Virginia. They've been leaders in this and working on it for about 20 years. So communication, handoffs, I tried to give you a little bit of context, but things that as I was thinking about this, I've certainly gravitated towards in my life. I didn't realize this, but whether it's flying, you know, aviation, the military, racing, they're all high-risk environments. They're all related to high performance, high reliability. One of the best overviews of communication that I've come across, and I can share with you these resources, and most of them I post on ResearchGate so that you would be able to look these up. So don't feel like if you don't get it, you're not ever going to. But group interactions in high-risk environment, and it was from this conference that was convened 2004 with healthcare, aviation, nuclear power, as you often hear. And they talked about better the team, the safer the world. Specifically, here they talk about improving communications. They give 8 recommendations, but I'll ask you to focus on the last 2, using standard phraseology and nurses talking more like doctors, meaning concisely, and doctors listening more like nurses, or attentively or actively. So let's dwell on 7, for example. If you've ever flown or listened to recordings of a cockpit, you'll hear things that make sense to those that do it, but it doesn't make a lot of sense to the outside world. It's standard phraseology. We do that in medicine, right? In the operating room or in the ICU, but these are some of the things that we have to make sure that everybody understands what we're talking about. And with respect to the nurses talking more like doctors or concisely, we think in bullet point format. It's not a shaggy dog story, but it's getting somebody's attention and helping them weight the information. But doctors, myself included, as my wife would tell you, impatient and probably not always listening as attentively or actively as we should. Enhancing predictability or the reliability. I'll focus your attention again on the red. Number 2, goal sheets, transparency, reduced duplication effort. This is something that we embraced early on, I think is incredibly important. Use the first person plural, we, not I. I find myself, quite frankly, editing most everything that I say and write and eliminating every possible I. These are truly team efforts. I don't know that it was always that way. We were talking a little bit earlier about the way things were when we started the journey 30, 35 years ago. It was quite different. I think there was a lot more I, the iconoclastic maverick type surgeon or surgeon intensivist, but in today's world, there's no question. There's many more people, experts, and it's a team effort. And again, focusing on the role of standardization, effective team functioning as it applies to rules, policies, procedures, just standard operating procedure and sort of the related shared mental model. So if you stop and think about these handoffs, there's a pre-handoff, there's arrival, there's dialogue, there's post-handoff. I mention these just so that you can categorize your thoughts. I mean, we probably all go through these things, but hopefully a little of this will help you organize your thought, maybe stimulate some good conversation here at the end. What about the elements of an effective handoff? We have verbal communication, we have written communication, we have transfer of responsibility. I can tell you over time, I used to listen to a lot of these handoffs, say from the unit to the floor, and depending on who was there and what time of day, there were a variety of questions and there was frustration, I'm sure, on both ends. And what I asked the teams to do, you've probably done much of the same in your own areas, but say, why don't you sit down with the people that we're commonly handing off to and ask, what is it they want to hear every time? Reduce that to a form, if you will. Write those things down. Send it to them in advance. We did that in the era of the fax machine. And then they would have something to go by, and that would then lead to that verbal communication, clarifying things, asking additional things, and then ultimately clarifying who's responsible. So system-based strategies that are related to this, again, the standardization, you've probably heard of IPAS or SBAR, and we'll go over that a little bit. The face-to-face verbal communication, interactive questioning, using written templates, optimizing the setting, and I'll give you examples of things that we've done to try to help with that and integrate these efforts, optimize scheduled team structure, and customizing for high-risk patients. Specifically, I think the value of quantifying things. This is something that Juan and I have talked a lot about with safety efforts, and it really gets down to having a common understanding and trying to make good decisions and eliminate biases. And it's amazing how valuable when you can use a quantified risk assessment of a patient that it gets people's attention. Some of the things we've toyed with, if I were to tell you, for instance, somebody's risk of death or major complication, that can be somewhat difficult to categorize. So even think high, low, medium type risk or red, yellow, green, that sort of thing. And I think the fear that our teams had when we've talked about categorizing like that is somehow, say, somebody that's lower risk might be overlooked, or we might draw too much attention to those that, say, are red and the highest of risk. But at the very least, quantifying this understanding and being able to share that in some format, I think, is incredibly important for the people that are ultimately taking responsibility for the patient. If you think about this through the lens of some of the other people that do similar work, Thaler and Sunstein, behavioral economy experts, talk about reliable statistical evidence outperforming the availability heuristic every time. If you haven't read some of their work, it's worth thinking about. But again, it's one of these things that if we have quantifiable, accurate information, it's better than the most recent case that we could think of. So again, I want to emphasize the importance of quantifying risk when it comes to this. So IPASS, illness severity, patient summary, action list, situational awareness, and contingency plans and synthesis by receiver. The common format, it's probably more letters than I can remember, but it's one of the tools that's readily available and worth thinking about. So let's go over that again. The IPASS introduction, introduce yourself, your role, your job, the patient, name, identifiers, age, sex, that sort of thing, the assessment, the situation, and then specific safety concerns. This baton part, I pass the baton, background, actions, timing, ownership, and what comes next. Again, I find that useful, but probably a little bit more laborious. I think in terms of situation, background, assessment, recommendation, and I'll tell you specifically, when I went from being a in-house resident to resident as a chief where people were calling, I remember thinking through this, and I hadn't had SBAR at that point as a mnemonic, but I said, first thing I want is the recommendation. Then I know exactly where you're taking me on this journey. Then you can give me the situation, the background, and how you got that assessment, because it helped me focus. Put another way, I remember one of the senior surgeons when I was a medical student talking about the presentation being like you were trying to sell a car. You wanted somebody to buy it, so you needed a story that supported it. And the value in this is beyond just communicating, but it helps us learn from each other too. If Juan, for instance, was making a recommendation and then giving me the situation background assessment, I would learn about what he's thinking. If he said this patient had appendicitis and here's why he came to that conclusion and they need an operation, then I hear it and I make my decision. Ultimately, we're going to find out what happens and we learn about each other. So I think it's incredibly important, again, not just purely from the handoff, but learning about your processes and ultimately your outcomes. This is a graphic example and something that I find incredibly valuable, but the Iaban drape packed abdomen. That's the op report. So somebody stabilized military surgery, and it's how they're transferred. Everything you need to know. I mentioned that we use goal sheets. Here's an example of our admission goal sheet, and I gratuitously put the image there showing us working remotely, or me in that case, from my office, and we cover three different facilities, and they can round on a patient, and we go through the goal sheet and all the key things that link actions, again, with leading key performance indicators and our outcomes. Multidisciplinary rounds, same sort of thing. We make rounds at 6:45 to 7:15, and I'll talk about that in a little bit more detail, I think, on the next slide, and then again at 3 o'clock. We go through the goal sheet on the left-hand side. I know it seems a little disfluent in the electronic health record, but the nurses will write down the key objective information, and on the right-hand side of that, we will go through what the plan is to continue to wean things or, say, to discontinue something item by item. It covers probably, kind of like Pareto's principle, 85% of the things that we think vital. We get done with that, is there anything else? And then we have a plain English read back. again, the importance of these sorts of things, the handoff, the communication rounds are vital, right? That's where you usually get your team together. It's the setting, the context for how to do these things. We went through a three-month process as our team evolved, it grew, and we realized we had some turnover, and it was important to get everybody on the same page. So we went through this lean project to specify design exactly how we wanted to make rounds. So we started out and we said, best time to be there, 6:45 in the morning. The reason was that's when the people were starting to show up for the 7 o'clock shift. We had to be done by 7:15 so the surgeons could be in the operating room. So one of the constraints in the project was it had to be from 6:45 to 7:15. The value in that is you avoid the, well, I don't know, I wasn't here sort of thing. You know, I just got this. The people that were here are gone. So that's eliminated. Again, surgeons are incorporated. We have 14 patients in this one particular unit where we were preparing to do this and then spread for our other involved cardiac surgery units so that we could synchronize the network care. That meant 14 patients, we had about 2 minutes per patient. As you might imagine, along the way, people said, you can't do that. And we said, well, that's the constraint. We need to do that. So we had roles, responsibilities, who was going to say what part were they going to present? And it sort of flowed like this. Nursing would present, followed by respiratory therapy on their part. Nursing would then continue through the other systems. Nurse practitioner that was on the night before would add anything. And then I would kind of summarize by using the goal sheet and essentially say, okay, here's what I heard. This is what I think we should be doing. Does that make sense? Any questions, concern? No. Next patient. Interestingly, we studied this for our system as we were developing the EICU, and we found that rounds, I think ours was by far the, what I would call the positive deviation, ours was the fastest. You know, some days rounds might only take 15 minutes, right? But they, I would say extraordinarily rare that they would take more than 30 minutes. But there were rounds in the medical ICU because of, let's say, in part the lack of organization, not exclusively because their patient population was different, but that they would take hours, you know, 2 hours, 2.5 hours. We got right down to exactly where everybody has to stand. There was pushback, you know, people say they didn't want to do these sorts of things, but you have to keep your patient and the team at the center of this. And again, this gets to being high performing, highly reliable, and making sure that you have standard operating procedure. I think when you do that, what ultimately happens is everybody knows their role, responsibility. They know exactly what's supposed to happen with the patient. They know what the routine is, and they can identify when things aren't on track. Again, I've continually alluded to our EICU. That adds another layer of complexity. At this point, our general EICU, not just the cardiac component, but covers over 300 beds in, I think it's at least 10 different facilities, and you might imagine each of them had their own way of doing things, but having a way to round, having a way to hand off, goal sheets, routines that we use for orders, that sort of thing, were imperative, and so this new technology had to drive a change in process. So we evolved from something that was, let's just say, a lot less rigorous to something that was far more rigorous, and it had to be the case. So personal things, again, I just touch on this. It's a select item that one needs to focus on, and it's human factors. One probably will stimulate some discussion about these things, but risk, as you know, is not just the patient's risk, but it's also the setting. So what happens when there's high complexity, and the complexity can be both patient, but you could have a variety of new people, or you could have people that are at the end of their shift and tired, that sort of thing. And we have to think of all of those things, again, to perform at a high level, to be highly reliable, deliver safe care. So with that in mind, and we're getting close to the end of this, we have to be thinking about sender-based strategies. Focus on this verbal handoff on vital items, emphasize tasks to be done, anticipatory guidance, ascertain receiver understanding. I learned this, I'm sure, many times along the way, but one was quite graphic where very emotional discussion about a patient and what was the best plan of care and discussing things with the family. And what I saw was we had talked extensively with the family, but when we actually stopped to ask them what they heard and what they wanted to do, it was markedly different than the many conversations and the time that we put in. So the same thing goes not just for families, but the teams. It's incredibly important for that read back, which can be very simple, like in the cardiac surgery world, pump off, somebody says pump off, you know that they heard you, but also to tell you in their own words what they heard, what they're thinking. Receiver-based strategies, again, read back, active listening. Some of this, and I mention this just so that people understand, policy, joint commission, you know, these handoffs in a structured way are demanded. It's a priority of the World Health Organization. With respect to education, evaluation, these are also things that are mandated by the American Association of Medical Colleges and the ACGME. So it's above and beyond just a good idea when joint commissioner ACGME says we should do that. So to give you context, again, not quite the handoff itself, but high performance, high reliability, and the results. This is what one effort, I talk about linking actions and leading key performance indicators and outcomes in this approach that we've had of deliberate multidisciplinary rounds, goal sheets, handoffs, they're all a part of what we describe here. Renal failure. When I got to the Carolinas in 2004, we had a renal failure rate in coronary only about three times the national average. And we essentially eliminated it in 2014. We had three out of 492 coronaries, or 0.6%, which is about one-fourth the national average. So back to that value equation, not only is it high quality, but if you look at, say, Virginia data, where they said that coronary acute renal failure is $49,100 a case, that's about a $1.3 million a year improvement. Our cardiac surgery program published on some of this work in 2008, and we had reduced risk-adjusted mortality by 40%, and with our CQI efforts, we reduced tamponade by 80%, sepsis by 50%, and at that point, renal failure had improved by 30%. Specifically with respect to handoffs, my friend Jay Shake, who's also involved this sort of thing, has published on this and talked about the efforts that they've done to hand off, improving involvement, critical details being improved, and it doesn't take any increased time. More recently, they published on this in cardiac surgery and showed that it improved satisfaction and some of these outcomes, as well as the accuracy of these handoffs. That said, most recently, I think this was just in the last month, if I remember, handoff among staff intensivists, and it was pretty alarming to me that half the time the diagnoses and goals were not conveyed or retained, which is incredible. So I guess what I'm trying to say in this is there are ways to do it, but it takes continuous attention. And so in summary, and again, this is aimed at sharing some things, stimulating some thought and some discussion amongst our panelists. Think about institutional learning and the data management analytics, high performance, high reliability, the continuous improvement. We talked about communication and the group interactions in high risk environment, the importance of having a way of doing things or standard operating procedure. Think strategically, integrating workflow, education, and compliance. So like I said, designing rounds, using goal sheets, that was all an integrated strategy. These aren't, like we often are bombarded with, just another thing to do, but how do we do all these things that are imperative on a daily basis, do it in the most high-performing and highly reliable way? And then again, in an environment, for instance, in the EICU or even in this digital health world of integrating this information, using it to our advantage so that our patients get what they need. With that in mind, I'll stop talking.